You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
I'm not going to attempt a summary of what was said. In the interest of time, I want to open the floor and give some time for questions from the floor and then allow our audience to come back with further clarifications. So can you please put your hands up and make sure that you introduce yourselves before you pose your question or your comment.
Good afternoon. My name is Cesar Marcillo from Ecuador Technological University. My question is about the consumption, because in this morning the presentations were focused in production case. The emphasis was the supply size. I think the demand size in social solidarity economy is no problem for the presentation and the speakers. The responsible consumers are in the local economy, in the regional economy, or in world economy. Is real or imagination my words? In these senses, I hear political publics try to promote the microcredit, the local development, the gender, the rural situation, education, and so on. My question is the consumer with an ecological and ethical and solidarity action ready to accept the social and solidarity economy? This question has relationship with this conference, Social and Solidarity Economy and its future. Is an alternative to capitalism, or is a simple effort the social movements without a real alternative? What are the limits and potential of social and solidarity economy for this response, for this chronology are here? Ecuador, you hear yesterday, has a constitution and a special law, inclusive a Buen Vivir Plan or Summa Causae, with a different form to recognize this economy. In other words, it's not only the social and solidarity economy.
Can you be brief, just to allow others to also raise questions? Would you mind summarizing your point, please? And if you have a question.
I am finished. Is economy is much more, like cultural, anthropological, and political themes. Thank you.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for the very enlightening presentations. My name is Patricia Muñoz Cabrera, and I'm a member of WIDE, Women in Development Europe. And my question is addressed to Carolina. I very much enjoyed your presentation. I just have one question. In Latin America, racism is one of our most fundamental and old enemies. And all our economies are structured along racial lines as well. So if we consider that there are gender tensions within households of indigenous origins, how do you visualize the role of racism in these tensions? How do you cross both variables? Thank you.
First and foremost, Madam Chairperson, I would just like to cast my vote of appreciation for this old ladies panel, and because it is very refreshing and empowering. My question is, the values of social solidarity economy are very different from the neoliberal economy. In fact, feminism as a movement is a social resistance to the neoliberal economy. So my question is, what are the values, ethical principles, that the feminist movement, the gender equity movement, has contributed to the building of social solidarity economy as an ethical-oriented approach to development? Now, let me just cite a few examples to, to drive the discussion. For example, social solidarity economy is considered to be a compassionate kind of economy. Now, compassionate is considered by many as a value that is feminist compared to performance-oriented, which is masculine, or this is the characteristic of social solidarity economy. So this is my question. I hope that the panel, you know, can contribute, because I think one of the contributions of the gender equity movement is to imbue social solidarity economy with this kind of values. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the very interesting presentations. I have learned a lot. My name is Naoko Otobe. I work in the ILO. I have three questions. First question is, would the social solidarity or the women's groups, especially the women's groups, would it work better in rural communities, or would it also work just as well in urban areas? That's one first question. Two, in the cases where federation was mentioned, what is the legal status? Do they have a legal personality, for example? And that leads to the third question. Then, what would be the government's role in terms of creating more conducive environment for promoting solidarity groups and social economy? Thank you.
There are lots of questions. In the interest of time, can you please keep your questions very brief?
Thank you very much. My name is Riyad Basia. I'm an independent consultant based in Geneva. I want to raise questions, only questions. How do you see to the contribution of women who migrants in local development? If you can develop more on this issue. And the second question also, how about the rural women? You know that rural development and rural women's its concept still running since many decades. International community recognized International Day for Rural Women. Did you exclude rural women from gender dynamics? Can you tell me more on this concept? Thank you.
Mine was just more a comment than a question, so I'd like to thank these presentations. My name is Anita Morim. I work in the ILO with South-South and Triangular Cooperation. I was for 8 years a gender focal point in an IPEC program for combating child labor, so I was very appreciative of the experiences of the South. Some of you actually are a part of the South-South scholars that came to this UNRWA's ILO conference. So just to thank you for bringing these experiences. It's this sharing of good practices from different countries that we're interested in, and also in this event. So not much of a question, but maybe thinking on how we can link up between the different experiences. Thanks.
Very quickly, I was thinking about how are social and solidarity economy organizations as employers. And I was wondering from the panelists, from your field work, what is your experience? There's a lot of volunteer work, community work, the gender dimensions of that. They do promote facilitation of self-employment, but what kind of employment is that, you know? You do marketing, you promote financing, what kind of employment? And then as employers, if they are value-driven businesses, what are their labor practices? How different are they from, you know, other micro, small entities, business employers, as employers?
Okay, thank you. I'm going to stop collecting questions because I think we need to give our panelists time, and they already have quite a few questions to come back to.
Yes, thank you. I will answer the question that was directed to me about racism. And of course, this was not a topic that I studied there, but of course it was very important because these women are not only women, but they are also indigenous. So this means they are double discriminated. But in the other side, I also think that in the case, for example, to get support from governmental institutions, this is also like two-sided weapon, because they, as they are indigenous and the governmental institution are trying or to say we are also helping indigenous women, they can make more use of all these tools and advantages, and maybe they have, in this case, more advantage are not us, not indigenous woman. But for the region, this is what I say, that it might cause the exclusion of the community, because specifically in this region you have the indigenous and the mestizos, one, and the mestizos women are very are not very happy that the indigenous women have such a success with this cooperative, and that in one time now, Cuzalapa is like, this cooperative is the central point, everybody's coming there, everybody is doing the indigenous, and the indigenous revalorization is also becoming more and more important. So I think in this case, it's a positive asset to be indigenous woman. Thank you.
The question you ask about the ethical principles that sort of feminism can contribute, it's not an easy one, given that we are just getting into the idea of SSE. But I keep thinking of the sort of insistence in different texts or discussions I have of subsistence political economies, of life-centered political economies, which sort of seek to, which is a very feminist orientation in itself, that, you know, that values life and ecology and, you know, above everything else. And I think maybe this is a direction. The question of federations and whether they have a legal status. In Ethiopia right now, there is talk of giving legal status to federations and having them operate autonomously. This is still, it's a difficult thing because I get the feeling that there's a reluctance among women's organizations to sort of let go of these things, these structures that they've nurtured. But it is probable that with the growth of self-help groups that there might be pressure to autonomize.
Thank you. I'll address a couple of questions. Firstly, I want to dispute the idea that either issues of ethics or compassion or even the question of taking up women's rights is somehow confined to women's groups or to women. The women's movement itself is a complex beast in every country. So suppose you take South Asia, women's movement would include urban women's groups, which are often middle class. It'll include a lot of gender progressive grassroots groups who are not necessarily women's groups. It'll include individual women. It'll include party, political party, women's caucuses. I mean, it can include a whole range of things. Whether it works better in one or the other, I'm not sure that one can actually make a generalization. It really depends on the conditions for collective action. A lot of groups in the South have there are different kinds of groups in urban and rural areas. Urban areas, typically, women have taken up issues of violence against women in particular. A lot of rural groups have taken up questions of livelihood, of poverty, of employment. And I think there have been examples where the two have not necessarily gelled. And that is why I'm arguing for a broadening of our conceptualization of what leads to an improvement in gender dynamics and women's rights, because there are many questions that have not been taken up by women's movements. For instance, in South Asia, when I was working 15 years ago on the question of women's property rights and land rights, there was virtually no taking up of that issue by any of the women's groups in the region. And the kinds of groups who I talked to, in fact, the idea was, well, we don't believe in private property. So I think the important thing is to broaden it up and call it much more of humanistic values. And I think if SSC has to move forward, then it should not be compartmentalized. And there are many women who take up positions of power who would not necessarily follow those values. Just take a couple of minutes more. The question of federation is interesting, and I mean the way you posed it was quite interesting, that do you formalize or not? I think FECOFAN, which is the Federation of Forest User Groups in Nepal, which is the only countrywide federation of its kind that I know of anywhere in the world, and which has mandated there should be 50% women members, is of course formalized, and it is registered body. But there are also informal associations, and depending on the local context, there is merit in being informal. sometimes, but there are also merits in being formalized. Just a final tale of an issue, which is Simmel's question about what kinds of employment. I think what they are, what people are working on is much more of livelihoods, which are not necessarily formal, but I think if you take India's example, it launched the Employment Guarantee Act, which gives every household 100 days of one person per household 100 days of guaranteed employment at the minimum wage. And the majority of those who are coming out and working are women, as it happens. So it is possible to take an act like that and actually to create conditions. It's mandatory to technically provide a creche for the women who have children. The problem doesn't lie in the legalization of these issues. The problem lies in the actual implementation on the ground. And I think there, in the Indian context, the Right to Information Act has become a very important empowerment tool in the hands of the poor, including women, in being able to ask questions of the state. Well, I was guaranteed so many days of employment. Why is it that I have not received that? So there are multiple tools which can be used to generate empowerment and rights, I think. And to Caroline, my question was, well, maybe if there's a critical mass of women, and maybe if what they're actually doing is collective action and not just being fed rather inappropriate rural development programs, I mean, we should long move out of pickle making and embroidery to real tasks, and perhaps then the men will support the women. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think Suzanne has said that in the interest of time and to let everyone practice their right to food, she will not want to comment any further. So I would like to stop by first thanking again our panelists for having provided, I think, a whole richness of perspectives, both conceptual, theoretical, as well as their sort of empirical findings from very different contexts, for reminding us of alternative non-capitalist economic practices, and that, you know, there is perhaps no such thing as pure capitalism, that we have complex hybrids and complex forms of capitalism, which include very much sort of non-paid, unpaid, non-capitalist forms of reproduction that in any way underpin the capitalist economy. That within those spaces, there are both a lot of cooperation and altruism, ethics of care, but also structures of oppression. Let's not idealize the unpaid economy as well, which does include oppressive structures sometimes, and it's not always voluntaristic. We have also heard a lot about the complexities of collective action, both the kind of tensions and conflicts within groups, even if they're women-only groups, but also when they're mixed groups, the heterogeneity of women as a social group, the importance of class dynamics and their intersection with gender, importance of race dynamics and intersections with gender. We have also heard a lot about the external relations between these groups and the broader economy, capital, but also the state, which, despite all the talk of the state disappearing, it seems to be very present in many contexts and not necessarily the kind of state, perhaps, that we would like to see in all contexts. So before we ask for bringing the state back in, perhaps we also want to ask what kind of state, its democratic credentials. And also I would like to thank our presenters for also raising the important sort of issues around gender dynamics within households and how that, and domestic sphere and community, and not again idealizing the community. Communities can be also very oppressive sites. They can reinforce social norms that are very restrictive towards women, but also other social groups. So I think we need to kind of keep that also on the cards. And looking at the dynamics and the interactions between these domestic spheres and community spheres and the whole complexities of collective action.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. Thank you for listening.